of force. A Mitsubishi or strict cousin may not, by their own chosen laws, indulge in fists and brawling, but humanist law accommodates those who sometimes wish to settle things with fists. Leslie was considering her aim when her eye caught the line of the dueling rapier almost hidden in the pleating of the Black Law's coat. Dominic smiled as he saw her dark eyes catch upon the sword, and he caressed its black hilt.
"When I catch the perpetrator, you can petition to have them tried under humanist law, but Black Sakura has already recommended a Romanovan panel. I would go with that if I were you. Their penalties tend to sting much more than yours. Shall I begin downstairs?"
Leslie shook herself to fight off the surreality of it all. "What do you mean you keep the peace among the gods?" Dominic gave a deeper smile, with a soft sound, almost like a purr, deep in his throat.
"I mean that when the 710 lists are printed, there will be no name in top seven whose house and office I do not frequent. I mean that your president, Ganymede, is quick to call me when a crisis needs decloying, and all other hive leaders do the same. I mean that I am how these sensitive matters are settled, are always settled, and I shall settle this one. Martin is the partner of my labors, but he's too gentle to impress on people what it is we really do. We keep the peace among those gods who govern those of you who choose to have a government."
Again, he grasped her like a dancing partner, caressing the small of her back and using her weight for his own spin as he bounded toward the steps, lithe as a show horse.
"I'll start downstairs, shall I? Out of your way?"
Leslie charged after him.
"Hold on! I need to know exactly what you'll be doing, step by step."
He paused on the top landing.
"The carpet is torn on this stair. You should have that seen to. Someone could trip and fall."
"What will you be doing? Imaging? Scanning? Viewing files?"
"Sniffing about, I told you. I'm here for the smell and taste of things. Have you any enemies?"
"No," Leslie answered instantly, then paused. "You asked me that before. What do you mean?"
"Anyone who would like to see your lives disrupted for personal reasons, rather than the obvious financial and political ones. A jilted lover? Family of a crash victim who blames you? A hobby competitor, perhaps? Sport? Someone the famous sniper keeps defeating?"
Sane questions calmed her.
"Not that I can think of. No one has been particularly upset by any crashes in the last few years."
He darted back up toward her, testing a vent with his fingertip, and, in the same motion, trapped her between his body and the wall.
"No old rivals? No one wronged in an affair?"
Leslie's eyes went wide, the change exaggerated by their Chinese contours. But something kept her from shoving him back.
"No."
Dominic leaned even closer, caressing the grating above Leslie's head, his chest not quite brushing hers.
"Your spouse is work-obsessed,"
he smiled, tasting her breath and letting her taste his.
"Have you had affairs?"
Blush bloomed on Leslie's cheeks. "Is it a sin in your morality, reader, for a married person to admire the body of a stranger? Is she less entitled to recognize the beauty of firm buttocks or the motions of a practiced hand? And, if you do consider it a sin, then am I right that this scene, virile Dominic with Leslie's small frame pressed against his, breast to breast, is more exciting for you because it is forbidden? Confess, reader." Something in you hungers for transgression here. "Show me, Mycroft. Strip that antique costume from the flesh beneath. Show me whether this she-man wears a strap-on. And, if so, have him use it. This woman, Leslie, doomed from childhood to be the prize for rivals Occam and Ojiro, let her revenge herself on them by cuckolding the victor here. Let them do it against the wall, or upstairs with Mukta looking on. And, for contrast, throw in limp Eureka and Sydney lounging in the background, blind in their permanent masturbation with the computer." It was in your mind, reader, was it not? complete with my he's and she's, which have infected you by now, but feel no guilt. It was in Leslie's mind as well, placed there by Dominic, who can summon more of the heat of pornography with a single gesture than I could with a thousand words. Like Princess Danae, reader, he trains. I have no time, Mycroft, for these thine interruptions, thy speculations, thy patriarch, thy Hobbes. My fantasy is not thy business. Give me truth. What did they do? Leslie pressed herself back against the wall, gaining an inch of breathing room. As a matter of fact, I haven't. Dominic's eyes did not believe. This is an open bash, yes? How many of your unmarried Barsibs date outside the bash? Any angry ex-lovers? Leslie is herself uncomfortable with the fact that her very sensible impulse to kick this black law in the nuts did not recur. Cato's not interested. But Thisbe has some angry exes, yes, and the twins might too. It's hard to track what the twins get up to, but they're always dating at least two people between them, usually more. I see. Dominic shifted his stance, just brushing the side of her thigh with his half-hidden scabbard. And are there rivalries within the Sunnier Weeksbooth bash? He asked. Everyone's content with who does what work, who takes what shifts, who sleeps with whom? Everyone's content. Occam and I monitor it all very carefully. His smile widened as he leaned close enough to savor her shampoo. All nine of you get along perfectly all the time. Like little angels? Perhaps one as strong as Leslie did not tremble. Boshmates squabble. It's healthy. I said we monitor it carefully. He retreated a few inches, testing whether her flesh would follow his. You and Monsieur Sidney Coons are exceptions. But the other seven were all born in this bash, yes? Seven children, and none of them wanted to go form a new bash with campus friends like a normal 20-something? That's very unusual. Her flesh did follow his, though possibly just to ease away from the wall. We like our work. And who's the weakest link in your bash? His fingers brushed the soft underside of her forearm. If I were a criminal, whom would I want to grab and torture? Who would break first? The touch of skin on skin was too much, broke the spell somehow, and Leslie scowled, pressing him away. I thought you said you were going to look at the house before you asked us questions.
That I did, madame. My apologies.
Dominic darted back at once, down the steps quick as a dragonfly. I'll stop down here, shall I? He threw wide the door of Thisbe's room before Leslie could reply. There's someone in here, madame. Did you know that? Not one of your bash. What? Dominic grasped his sword hilt as he filled the doorway. Explain yourself. I'm waiting for Thisbe, came a timid voice from below. I'm their sensei. It was Carlyle, reader. Mercifully, it was Carlyle. Back again, with a fresh round of questions. But it could as easily have been the child. Right, Leslie cried. I'd forgotten they were back again. Sensei? Dominic repeated. Yes, can I help you? Carlyle approached, his pale face beaming energy, for he had risen full of strength that day, since March the 24th was the feast of the Norse god Heimdall, a day on which men had honored their creators in ages past and still do today. Dominic read Carlyle's body as a butcher scans the contours of a pig. You're a sensei. You too, I see. Carlyle nodded to the scarf on Dominic's shoulders. Are you a set-set specialist? Eureka Weeksbooth was hoping for one. Dominic stared, eyes marking the contours of Carlyle's face, the sharp blue of his eyes. What's your name, cousine? He pronounced cousin like the French feminine. Carlyle Foster?
Carlyle Foster.
Yes. Is something wrong? How old are you? Carlyle is, like Dominic and Leslie, in that medically extended stretch of youth that makes it impossible to distinguish 18 from 38. 28? Why do you ask? And you're a sincere. Yes. The gag gene dug his fingers into his wrap, patterned today with abstract elephants in white on blue. Is something wrong? Dominic's laugh is complex. It begins with silence, a stare which drags out for a few seconds before the first breath comes, almost a hiccup. Then more silence before the next, staccato gasps closer and closer until finally the voice and bitter smile arrive together as Dominic throws his head back into a climactic, thirsty gasp. Carlyle shivered when he described the experience to me, and compared it to how he imagines John Calvin might have laughed as he witnessed some atrocity, smug at finding proof that this fallen world was truly as despicable as his sermons taught. Carlyle tried, he said, to ask what was so funny, whether he had done something wrong, but the horror of the laugh kept killing his words before they could take wing. In the end, Dominic answered only with the merciful command, "Get out." "What? Get out of this room. You're distracting me from my investigation, Carlyle Foster." He laughed again, as if the name revealed some new double entendre on second hearing. "Get out before I change my mind. You can wait for your Thisbe upstairs." Carlyle was quickly herded out into the stairwell and almost tumbled into Leslie as Dominic sealed Thisbe's door behind him. To my knowledge, not even Martin has ever witnessed Dominic searching a room, so powerful is his preference for solitude. How does he work? By simple sight and touch? A concealed machine? By scent, perhaps? The insanity of his devotion driving his mind to develop that sense which feels most right for such a creature. Can you imagine him, reader, on his knees, boot leather creaking as he sniffs the carpet centimeter by centimeter? He answers happily enough to Canis Domini, Hound of the Lord, the old pun on Dominicani, the Dominican monks who hunted truth and heresy in heaven's name and that of their great founder. Whatever Dominic's technique, it misses nothing. Not a hair, not a stain, not the handprint of a 5-centimeter soldier on the barrel of a marker I forgot to wipe. "Who was that?" Carlyle asked outside, still staring at the door. "Dominic S. something." Leslie was still short of breath, but she turned a smile on Carlyle as the two found themselves united by mutual bewilderment. "Is it just me, or is that the weirdest person you've ever met?" "I'm something of a specialist, so I meet some odd people, but that was certainly in the top 10 for weird." She chuckled as she offered him a hand. "We haven't met. I'm Leslie Sanier." He matched her smile. "Nice to meet you, Member Sanier. Leslie, please." "Leslie," Carlyle repeated. I think I remember hearing about a black law sensei called Dominic. You don't forget a name like that." "What did you hear about them?" "Not much. I think they were well thought of by the conclave." She stared. "Why?" "I could ask." "Please do." "Of course." He started composing a message through his tracker. Leslie, too, shut off quick messages to Occam, Martin, 2 security captains, and her president's office to make sure this improbable creature really was dispatched by Romanova. All would answer yes. "I don't know whether it would feel normal for another black law, but I don't want someone like that as my sensei. My guess is they're a gadfly specialist. Some senseis practice a special aggressive style, so you can do a one-time session with them if you really want to be pushed to the core, and then you and your usual sensei work on the new questions it raises. The black law mystique would certainly work to enhance the feeling of danger." Leslie, who had tasted more deeply of Dominic's aggressive style, frowned. Carlyle mustered his most energetic smile. "Speaking of returning to your usual sensaire, would you like to talk about whether or not there's some kind of divinity or divine force in the universe?" Leslie laughed a warm and healthy laugh, healing for both of them. "Sure, why not? We're supposed to have a session soon anyway. We can get it over with. Good way to pass the time while we wait for that creature to get out of my house." Her feet strayed kitchenward. "Come have some figs." One of the twins was on a crazy fig kick when they programmed the tree last month, so we've got a zillion more than we'll ever eat. Together, armed with kitchen warmth and metaphysics, the two spent a good hour erasing the after-chill of their encounter. They did not see Dominic again, they said, nor did the others in the Bash. He might have searched just Thisbe's room, or he might have passed through the whole house, silent as a plague. Either way, he vanished without another question. Chapter the Eighth. A Place of Honor. Martin. "Mycroft, thanks for calling back. Supposedly there was a device you had that you used to disrupt the trackers and make it seem you were in one place when you went another." I know the one you mean, Nepos. The Gyges device, called Canner device by many. We spoke Latin, reader, or rather its gentled grandchild, Masonic Neo-Latin, stripped of irregulars and excess declensions, but close enough to its imperial progenitor to invoke grand capitals and ancient marbles. I always cringe when I must translate Hive or Strat tongues into common English for you. But it is worse with Martin, knowing that he thinks so differently in the two tongues, and cringes himself when he sees his words conceived in the imperial tongue mangled by the vulgar. I will translate, to help you understand. But I have begged permission to leave in Latin words whose English sense is intolerably wrong. Take, for example, Nepos, this title of honor which marks Martin as the student, servant, intimate, and protege of his emperor, trusted even to sign laws and contracts in the emperor's name. To render Nepos as nephew for you would be one part translation, three parts lie. Martin. I believe the device might have been used in this black sakura theft. I saw your scan of the folded paper. Martin, what can you tell me about the device? Could it have penetrated the Sanir Weeksbooth Bash defenses? Are you asking me on behalf of Romanova and the law, or privately? A pause proved that Martin understood the weight of my question. Privately. It was never in my hands, Nepos. I only ever had the packaging. I just pretended that I had the device to confuse the police. Please keep it private. The chief inspector doesn't know. But yesterday, Princess Danae forced it out of me in front of Chief Director Ando. I tried to resist, I swear. They're sure to use it against me. If Papadelius finds out, they'll be all over me. It could wreck my parole. Worse, I don't know what to do. I'm sorry, I should have come straight to you. Martin. Calm, Mycroft, calm. The Chief Director is a friend. They don't want to lock you up any more than I do. Aye, but the Princess, Martin, is also a friend. Relax. I'll speak to both of them about this, if you like. Aye, you will? The promise washed the tension from me like a welcome summer rain. Martin, I shall. But what I need now is for you to focus and tell me what you know about this Gyges device. Do you know who has it, or who made it? Reports from the original scandal blame organized crime. But when I read the report the Mitsubishi police sent in to Romanova, I found it not without omissions. The clever insult in his Latin understatement, which my poor translation butchers, cheered me enough to smile. I investigated at the time. I believe There never was any Yakuza-run secret research center, like the report claims. I believe the device was produced in secret, but funded and authorized by someone within the Japanese Mitsubishi leadership, and stolen from them by traitors within the same. But I have no proof. And also, Nepos, if the chief director and the princess are friendly now, they will not be friendly long if we start poking at this. If it was the Japanese bloc leadership which authorized research into tricking the tracker system, Ando would not want anyone to know. Especially not Caesar. Martin, you say powers within the Mitsubishi faction, not Ando himself? I. Not Ando, Nepos. I am certain of that. It was probably Ando's predecessor, but you know the Mitsubishi. That wouldn't lessen the demand that the current Japanese director take responsibility in the grimmest sense, and there is a pit of vipers waiting for Ando to stumble on the tightrope. Martin, you faked having the device. Do you know enough about it to determine with certainty whether it was really used in this theft or whether this is a hoax like yours? I. No, Nepos. I have no idea how the device really worked. Just that it affected trackers, swapping signals to make people hard to trace. Martin, I see. I. Chief Director Ando ordered me to try to track down the thieves from 13 years ago through the contacts I originally bought the packaging from. Martin, yes, good idea. Report what you find to me, but not today. It's Independence Day. Give yourself a day to breathe and work tomorrow. Yes, Nepos. Thank you. You enjoy it too. I ended the call and turned with a smile to Soo-hyun and Toshi, who had waited with me on the steps just outside the main gate of the censor's office, as deaf to my Latin as I am to dolphin song. Soo-hyun whistled in his impatience. Mycroft, how many more messages do you have? Only one more. The last was text, in French. Mycroft, we heard a certain thoughtless soul dragged you away from the Marseille spill this morning before you received your breakfast. France owes you a meal. Attend my party tonight. La Tremouille. The humanist president's order was consonant with Martin's, so I determined to obey. Sorry that took so long, I apologized. Shall we get back to work? No. The censor himself intercepted us as we tried to remount his steps. He was much changed from an hour before, relaxed and energized by having mastered the data, as a musician is relaxed and energized by having instrument in hand. The numbers are as good as we're going to get until we know more about how Black Sakura is going to go about announcing Masami's involvement. Toshi winced. Soo-hyun frowned. You just want to make it to the speeches on time, don't you? The censor clapped his deputy on the shoulder. So do you. Toshi, you coming? She hesitated, tilting her face away until her dark frizz, fiery like a corona in the sunlight, hid her expression. I'll go home to Togenkyo, if you don't mind. My sibs always play basketball the afternoon before the party, and I'd like to be there for Masami today. The censor's smile was all warmth. Of course. Give them my best. Tell them not to worry too much. It shouldn't be hard to spin things right. I'll make some private calls. Thank you. Vivian nodded in promise, then raced down the steps like a schoolchild at recess. Soo-hyun and the censor's guards followed with no less energy. Come along, Mycroft.
Will you join us too, reader? You may object that you know the festival already, but have you ever really seen the speeches live in person? Or do you, like many, prefer your beach retreats and family dinners and skip the history lecture? Thomas Carlyle and our other luminaries are like old candles and can still shed new light if you pause to light them. And it will be good to glimpse the lights of our age one last time, before they fade like starlight as the sun glare of an elder era dawns once more. We walked together along the Via Sacra, past the rostra and the Senate House, empty for once, then around the Capitoline Hill to the teeming street which separates the Forum from the Pantheon. The stores were all flags, as if Athena had covered the city with her weavings, every strat from the Irish to the Dog Show Society adding its colors to the sea. Vendors' carts, bright balloons, candies, sausages, and paper lanterns lined the thronging street. Even the statues dressed for the holiday, vandals decking them with garlands and bedsheets, stuffing their hands with flowers and empty liquor bottles. Such defacement would have been criminal in old Rome, whose statues represented gods. But Romanova's human heroes have a sense of humor. Everyone we passed had smiles for the censor and good wishes, some drunk enough to be almost rude, but nothing could dim his smile. Not even the teens who half-drenched him with a splash from one of his own fountains. Hey, Ancelé! Happy Renunciation Day! The Pantheon is as solid as a mountain, but airy too, after the narrowness of Romanova's streets, as when a narrow, crawling cave opens into a massive cavern which feels vaster somehow than the open sky. Pure sun streams in through the open hole in the center of the dome, wind, too, and rain, since not even the elements are denied access to this universal sanctuary. The old Romans built their pantheon for all the gods. But even in the age of geographic nations, a more earthly passion began to fill it with tombs of founders, saviors, artists, and, in Paris's copy, even our patriarch Voltaire. Our version in Romanova is well-populated, but far from full. Our priests, Mertisse McKay and Fisher G. Garay, our princes, Antonius Mason, Mycroft Mason, two kings of Spain, the first Anonymous, the third, our geniuses, Adolf Richter Brill and Regan Makoto Cullen, Terra, the moon baby, of course, artists, humanitarians, celebrities, and always with the most flowers wilting around him, the first Gordian chairman, Thomas Carlyle. Apollo Mojave is not with them. You should not have voted him down, reader. I know you could not understand why the emperor and others wanted a hero's burial for this young utopian you had not heard of until his death, but you should have trusted them. You should have. You know what the Utopians have given you, yet you grant them only one grave in the temple which honors at least three from every other hive. Your leaders meant it when they said, he was the best of us. He should be there, ungrateful reader. You should at least have granted him Olympus, since he could not join his kin among the stars. When we arrived, the actor who was to portray Chairman Carlyle today was already at the podium between the tombs, in costume in that signature green suit with its antiquated tapered necktie. Terry Lulli has made a career of playing our world's hero in plays and films, even once playing Carlyle's namesake, the 19th century historian Thomas Carlyle, distant great-uncle to our world hero. The historian Carlyle argued that human progress is shaped and triggered primarily by great men, which nature somehow drops into our midst. What would he not have given to be able to peek into the future and use his great descendant as an example? Mycroft, you made it! I told you they wouldn't miss it. You just guessed, you didn't know. At once my servicer fellows were around me, a sea of smiles and beige-gray dappled uniforms. They had colonized four benches in the back left corner by the bust and ashes of Sofia Kovac, who, inspired by St. Sir Thomas More, founded the servicer program, which keeps these guilty but benign offenders from rotting in prison with the malicious and insane. Mycroft, want some caramel crunch? A nice cousin bought us some. We saved you a seat, too, right here. They had, dead center. And I could sense the aftermath of some squabbling over who would get to sit beside me. Perhaps you cannot imagine life when you can no longer summon cars at will, when you are trapped within the reach of your own feet unless some benefactor calls you elsewhere. A benefactor, too, is needed to pay admission to a film, a play, a party, €5 to climb the scenic tower, €1 to ride the Ferris wheel. But public compassion has not left us with nothing. I count it among my few unequivocally good deeds that I petition to have the Renunciation Day speeches added to the short list of entertainments any servicer may, at the kind cousin's expense, attend. "No working over your tracker during the speeches, Mycroft," the censor warned me, his dark face warm and stern at once. "I want you resting. You need it." "Yes, censor." The rest around me were staring fixedly at the censor, who tried his best to be non-threatening, slouching to diminish his physique. But that blood-purple uniform still raises and topples hives. There was one sure way to heal the mood. "How many of you want ice cream when this is over?" 4 hands shot up, then 11, then all. "You got it. Hurry, Vivian." Soo-hyung tugged his arm. "It's beginning." Together, censor and deputy raced to their reserved seats at the front, almost in time to avoid a smirk from Terry Lulli, who waited on the podium for Romanova's highest officer to get his butt in his seat. Those who introduce the speeches always ask you to imagine that it is the year 2131. You are terrified by the ever-climbing mortality figures of the latest attacks, more terrified at the backlash promised by the superpower, and most terrified of all by the means it has chosen to replenish its armies, thinned by long prosperity. You know that Chairman Carlyle has spent the last 30 hours cloistered with Cousins Program Director Sofia Kovac and Olympic Chairman Jean-Pierre Utarutu, the three great Mukta transit groups, which can all evacuate members from continent to continent to evade a draft as easily as to watch a sports match. Now these three have called a press conference and bring with them onto the dais Europe's hero, King Juan Valentin of Spain. You cannot guess their plan, but you know it will set the shape of this new world war, and that they have the most affluent third of the world's population behind them. Fear is what the introducer asks you to imagine, the anxiety of living in a world the bomb might end at any moment, and hope, too, fragile, resting in this man. He speaks. "When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands that have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate but equal station to which the laws of nature entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation." These words are as true today as they were 350 years ago, when a group of idealists set out to found a new kind of nation, freer than any that had come before. The nation they founded became great, and remained great, even in our lifetimes. But it is not great today. No nation, whatever its power, can be called great when it imposes tyranny upon its citizens, worse, upon people it claims as its citizens. Not because they have enjoyed the fruits of its soil or benefited from its protections, but because by chance their grandparents were born within that blotch of color on a map it calls its own. These free people, who have never spent more than an afternoon beneath its skies, these people proud America now commands to surrender the fruits of their labors. Why? To finance a war, no, a campaign of destruction, waged not between peoples, but between the members of governments, and justified in the name of two gods, two interpretations of God, in whom most of those who must now pay do not believe. Worse, this so-called nation dares not merely to ask, but to compel these free people to send their children to fight and die for a group of men they do not call leaders, against a foe they do not call enemy, over a patch of ground they have never called home. Friends, An America who would impose these orders is no longer the champion of liberty its founders set out to create. It cannot command our loyalty. I must interrupt to ask, reader, did you spot Carlyle's omission? Nature's God. As it flowed from Jefferson's pen, it was the laws of nature and nature's God that entitled a people to separate but equal station among the powers of the earth, not nature alone. Chairman Carlyle was no atheist. What you see here is the beginning of the silence. As the first bombs of the church war rain down, those who consider themselves neutral are now afraid to mention the divinity. What is a people? The speech continues, the actor's voice resonating through the dome. It is a group of human beings united by a common bond, not of blood or geography, but of friendship and trust. What is a nation? It is a government formed by a people to protect that common bond with common laws, so its members may enjoy life, liberty, happiness, justice, and all those rights we love. Americans, America is no longer your nation. Your nation is the friends who live and work with you in Africa, Europe, Asia, Australia, all of the Americas, and all the other corners of this earth. Your nation is those who went to school with you, who cheered beside you at games, who grew up with you, traded intimacies with you over the internet, and still today break bread with you in your own house on whatever continent it stands. Your nation is the organization which you chose to protect your family and property in sickness and in health as you traveled the globe to find your ideal home. Friends, I stand here today with the leaders of these organizations to tell you that once again the time has come to found a new kind of nation, freer than any that has come before. We speak today for the cousins, for the Olympians, and for Gordian, three groups which have the means to allow a human being or a family to live in this world without a country, without citizenship, without obligations to any power you have not chosen to join. For more than a generation, we have not just been your travel agents, but your banks, your lawyers, your hospitals, your schools. Now let us be your nations. I call on all Americans who do not support this war to renounce your citizenship and trust us. Any one of us, you have your pick. Let us protect you and your families in this new free world. I call on all the citizens of all other countries of the world to respect our members and accept the passports we will issue, just as you would the passports printed by a country which can boast a blotch of territory somewhere on the globe. Join us if you like, or remain loyal to those geographic nations which still merit loyalty. But either way, acknowledge us, and in acknowledging us, acknowledge the right of all human beings to choose a different nation, if the nations of their birth betray their trust. Historically, Sofia Kovach took the podium second after Carlyle. No one remembers her speech. The technicalities of how to apply to join these new non-geographic nations, and how they will handle deeds and taxes, legal suits and health care. She's like the big sister packing our backpacks for the camping trip, who tries to make us pay attention as she goes through the items, but we ignore her, entranced already by the wild's call. Only later, when we find we need our bug spray and our lanterns, then we will discover that they are ready in our bags, between our lunchbox and our favorite toy. We don't thank her, but she watches us frolic carefree, thanks to her good sense, and asks no more. Today, the part of Sofia Kovach was played not by an actress, but by her modern counterpart, Briar Kosala, chair of the Cousins. She was costumed for the occasion in a woman's business suit styled after fashions of the turn of the millennium, complete with tight skirt and high heels she could barely walk in, her lush, black Indian hair woven into a stately bun. But even in the androgyny of her everyday cousin's wrap, she would still seem every inch a woman. I think there is no person, myself aside, so hated by the ambitious of this world as Briar Cosulla, since those who fight viciously to grasp the reins of power cannot forgive the fact that she could rise so high and still be nice. Think of Ando, struggling to make himself the main head of the Mitsubishi Hydra. Think of Europe's parliamentary campaigns, of the glitter and furor of humanist elections. Briar Cosulla just likes helping people, and is good at running things. And when invited to become the world's mom, she said, sure. That is what the chief cousin is, the world's mom, as surely as the Masonic Emperor is Earth's stern father. Her hive runs the charities, the orphanages, the nursing homes, the kind servicer program. Her law is the most forgiving, her newspaper the most sentimental, and when disaster strikes, she is first to arrive with nurses, soup, and playgrounds. Little wonder that this friendly matriarch, still smiling as she rules the 1.6 billion members of Earth's second largest hive, is the leader whose position in the 710 lists, high or low, the fewest papers could agree on. The third speech, Olympic chairman Jean-Pierre Utarutu's, was delivered by an actor, since the Olympian hive was long since swallowed by the humanists, and the humanist president has more important work on Renunciation Day than assuring a bored audience that there will still be sports teams in this brave new world. Historians insist that Utarutu's contribution was as vital as the others, and I believe it, since there were already almost a billion subscribers who trusted the Olympic Transportation Union to clear their flights as they jaunted from continent to continent for the World Cup or the Winter Games or work. In the final speech, the words of the King of Spain were naturally read by the King of Spain. Friends, all this is not as sudden as it seems. These three are not rash radicals or business tycoons drunk with their own power. They are all taking an inevitable step. The European Union has long recognized that it is absurd to force someone with a father from one country, a mother from another, raised in a third, and working in a fourth, to pledge allegiance to one arbitrary geographic nation. More than 60 years ago, we instituted floating citizenship, so children of mixed parents would not be compelled to choose between several equal fatherlands. It was not the end of our countries. Almost everyone still prefers to have a homeland to love and return to, and the legal possibility of life without a homeland does not destroy the bonds of culture, language, and history which make a homeland home. What Chairman Carlyle proposes today is nothing more radical than extending that floating citizenship to the world. I stand before you today, both as a representative of the European Union and as the King of Spain. As a representative of the European Union, I am authorized to announce that we too will be offering floating citizenship to any citizen who wants to leave America or any other geographic nation, whether involved in the war or not. Our floating citizenship will be equivalent in every way to what chairpersons Carlyle, Kovac, and Utarutu are offering through their non-geographic nations. New floating citizens of the European Union may then apply for citizenship in a specific country, if they find one whose laws and ideals match their own. Or they may remain citizens of the EU only, the same two options that native-born floating citizens enjoy. Those who are frightened of your current countries may think of us as a fourth option, ready to welcome you as the Olympic Committee, the Cousins, and Gordian are. Separately, as the King of Spain, and with no directive from the European Union, I wish to express my personal support for Chairman Carlyle and his ideal that citizenship should be voluntary, not forced. To that end, I hereby call on all Spanish citizens, no, on all people who consider Spanish identity an important part of who they are, to show their support for that ideal by renouncing their citizenship, becoming floating citizens of the EU for 24 hours, and then reapplying to become Spanish citizens again, this time by choice. What we choose means more than what is handed to us by chance. I will count every citizen who leaves and rejoins my country as a more loyal Spaniard, a more sincere Spaniard, a truer Spaniard than before. And I will stand proud as the king of a people brave enough to leave our fatherland to show support for those endangered by this war, but loyal enough to return again. The delivery was perfect. The current king, Isabel Carlos II, has watched the recording of his ancestor so many times that he knows not just the words, but the gestures and the pauses. Later this year, Spain will go mad with joy as it celebrates King Isabel Carlos's 60th birthday and his 20th year on the throne. But I prefer to let you meet him here, in this plainer ceremony. He is a calm man. Not as moving as the actors, but precise and perfect in his duties, a human man, holding himself to the elevated standards of a king. His hair is not quite black, his face mild and subtly Asian due to a Chinese grandmother, and his fine gray suit today is a replica of his ancestors, those simple suits of the early millennium when opulence was expressed only in the expense of cloth and cut. The king can only attend this ceremony today because of the recent scandal. Otherwise, he would be at the European Grand Parade, where Europe's second choice, Casimir Perry, has been grudgingly given the seat of honor. But we, who could see His Majesty's face, knew he was happier here, reciting his ancestors' address than there, delivering a speechwriter's concoction to 100,000 voters. Ice cream! The demand rose from the servicers around me even before the applause had died. Oh, they discussed the performance, too, the first-timers especially, moved by the event, and by seeing three world leaders dignify it with their attendance. But a person's reflections on the foundations of our world are private, and I will not intrude on yours by offering those of a lowly servicer. Ice cream! Ice cream! Ice cream! The chant was powerless to call the censor away from the dais as he waited for Cousin Chair Briar Casala to teeter over to him on her mad high heels and plant a light kiss on his cheek. You said you couldn't make it. I was wrong. Vivian gave her a practiced squeeze, though they clunked shoulders briefly since the costume shoes made Chair Casala 8 centimeters taller than the couple was used to. You are great again. Really great. Jung Soo Hyung Ansele Kosala demanded her rightful hug in turn. Vivian stepped back so he could admire his spouse and Ba Kid together, especially what the gendered period costume did to Briar's figure. It was striking. The crisp outline hugging breasts and hips, which we usually saw only through the contoured drapery of a cousin's wrap. The deep blue of the suit fabric enhanced the subtle amber underglow of Casala's deep Indian skin, and the extra height exaggerated her tall, imperious beauty. The long chin, long nose, and high forehead, which make her face commanding and otherworldly, almost stylized, like a mask or statue staring down at you from some lofty other realm. I hate speaking in this dome. I can never tell if someone else is talking over me or if it's just the echo. No one was talking, Vivian assured. I think most of them were actually listening. Not me, of course. She gave her spouse a mock shove, then saw the crowd of servicers approaching. Oh, hello there, name, name, name. I cannot list my comrades' names here, Chair Kosala herself, as service program director, has censored them. I won't ask if you liked it, since you're bound to say you did. But tell me, was my diction clear on tax bracket back taxing? I always muddle that. My comrades were staring at the faces, so often seen on newscasts, now abruptly real. I don't remember, Chair Kosala, I answered honestly. If it had been conspicuous, I would remember. She did not have a smile from Mycroft Canner. What is it? You're all staring at Vivian as if something's supposed to happen. The least timid of them answered. The censor promised us ice cream. What? Only ice cream? No hot fudge or whipped cream or strawberries? We can't have that. Vivian rolled his eyes. Chair Kosala reached to comb his dreadlocks with her long fingers, not because the locks were actually must, but because she still enjoys the feel of them. Be sparing with the Romanovan budget, dear, not ours. Come on, everyone. Vivian's getting us super deluxe sundaes. Cheers drowned the censor's choking groan. Terry Kirabo, you come too. She called the actors over. Your Majesty, would you care to join us? The King of Spain smiled across at us from near the podium. Thank you, Chair Kosala, but no. I have another obligation. Mycroft. For privacy's sake, he addressed me in Spanish. Did La Tremouille summon you to the party tonight? I replied in Spanish. Yes, Your Majesty, they did. What excuse did they give? A very flimsy one, Your Majesty. Not worth repeating. Spain frowned. I spoke to Jade Mason about this invasion of the Saneer Weeksbooth Bash. Of course, His Majesty did not say Jed Mason, but as I approximate Spanish with English, so I substitute the name you recognize for one you would not. They see more in this than just a prank. Then I believe it, I answered. Thank you for broaching the question. Someone had to. Yes. Until tonight, Mycroft. I bobbed my slouching bow. Until tonight, Your Majesty. Chair Kosala and the censor watched as Spain graced me with his words, but they would not intrude. As for my fellow servicers, most here knew me well enough not to be surprised, and the rest would mistake me for a Spaniard. An aide came now, and offered the cousin chair sane shoes in trade for her costume heels. To the Sunday bar, she cried, and strode down the aisle like Athena before her armies, bodyguards holding the flanks like victories. She usually has at least 4 guards, though on this crowded day I spotted 10, glad of their numbers as the convicts schooled around their ward. I did not follow the happy band of princes and paupers, united here by the magic of sugar and cream. Only Su Hyun noticed that I lagged behind. Mycroft, you coming? I'll catch up. We have only honored 4 of our heroes today. I should pay my respects to the rest before departing. Hearing my reason, Su Hyun joined me. We visited each tomb around the dome in turn, rereading epitaphs, admiring busts, and contemplating the many different human foundation blocks which formed our world. It was somewhat satisfying, but only somewhat. Jung Soo-hyung Ansele Kosala is a good person, a worthy successor to the censor and deserving of a place on a legitimate 710 list someday. But Soo-hyung, like you, reader, would not have understood if I explained that the grave I most wished to honor was not there in the Pantheon. Chapter the 9th. Every Soul That Ever Died. Thisbe, I love you. Go away or I'll call the police. We have something special here, Thisbe, something eternal. I know you felt it too, that night on the cliffs. How can you throw that away? We don't have anything. You have an obsession. Now leave, and if I ever catch you around here again, I'll have one of my Basibs break both your kneecaps. You're torturing me, Thisbe. You brought this on yourself. I can't live without you. Then go away and die. The witch swept in through the front door of the Bash House with a bounce in her gait and a smile on her lips as if she had a mouthful of chocolate truffle. "Did I forget to tell you Thisbe is a witch? I know you won't believe me, but she is. A real witch, mistress of secret hexes that can warp the soul into whatever parody she wills. Did you not see on first meeting how her first impulse was to steal Carlyle's memory with her pill potions? That was a witch's instinct, as is the pride she takes here in a discarded lover's pain. You find it strange that I trusted a witch to guard Bridger? I would not bring any normal child to her, but for Bridger, Thisbe was the perfect guardian. To Thisbe, every secret from her brother's security passwords to my name is another chapter for her spellbook arsenal, and Bridger is the greatest spell of all. Hi, Leslie. Thisbe beamed as she entered the living room and found slouched in the comfort of the sofa her dear... Actually, it is difficult to decide whether to call Leslie Thisbe's Ba-Sib or her Bosh-mate, since adopted Leslie is not a Ba-Sib born in Thisbe's Bosh, but neither is she a Bosh-mate chosen in adulthood. Either way, Thisbe smiles on her like family. Oh, and Carlyle, you're here too, good. She nodded to the sensei, who had made a nest of cushions on the sofa opposite. Sorry to keep you waiting. I'm sure you want to get our session done so you can get back to the festivities. Leslie scooted forward on the sofa, ruining the doodles her fingertip had traced into the plush. Is Holly stalking you again? No, this is a new one. I'll handle it. Thisbe's fast fingers pulled the pins from her hair and let its black torrent tumble free from the prison of a professional clip. Did everything arrive for the barbecue? Yes, though I can't imagine how the nine of us are supposed to eat all that in one day. What are the twins growing in the meat maker, a whole bison? Leslie rose and offered Carlyle a hand up from the couch, whose down soft foam threatened to trap him in its comfort. Thanks for the session. Another the Tuesday after next? 3 o'clock, he verified. Thisbe took the least squished fig from the still-too-full bowl on the side table. Wait, you two just had a session? Carlyle smiled. Yes, but I don't mind doing another right away. You're not too tired? He shook his head. I do it all the time. Thisbe chuckled. Quite the voker, aren't you? Carlyle beamed. Shall we? Thisbe led Carlyle downstairs to the darkness of her bedroom, which showed no sign of Dominic's intrusion. But she did not stop there, stepping out instead into the wildflower trench. Are you taking me to them? Carlyle felt the need to whisper it. To Bridger? Yes. Carlyle tiptoed behind her, savoring the song of insects, the buffeting of grass fluff aglow with slanting sun. To an expert, his delight in the book of nature might betray something of Carlyle's own beliefs, which his sensei's vows forbid him to discuss. But I will not strip him naked yet. Eavesdropping through Thisbe's tracker, I caught the warning whistle of the lookout as the soldiers spotted the approaching pair. But I doubt that a child of peace like Carlyle could differentiate all clear from birdsong. Welcome, Carlyle, Thisbe. Thanks for coming out on a holiday. It was the Major's voice, seasoned and powerful, like an old piano which sounds better than new ones because it's yours. Thisbe spotted the soldiers, assembled in an upside-down plastic bucket with chips of wood as benches pulled close around a small block, draped like a banquet table. No problem, Major. I brought something special today. All right, 3 cheers for Thisbe. Set it here. Thisbe drew a small box from her pocket, and from it unpacked a tiny banquet in colored clay. Cheeses, salami, French bread, pea-sized apples and peaches, a tiny roast fowl with the brown and green speckles of stuffing painted around the edge, milk, wine bottles with tiny, intricate labels, plates of cookies and croissants, even a three-tiered wedding cake 2 centimeters tall.
Look at all that grub. You're a goddess of plenty, Thisbe.
Thisbe basked in their thanks as she set out the tiny meal. Most of the food was not quite to scale with the soldiers, apples the size of volleyballs in their arms, the wine bottles standing higher than the knees of the men who struggled to stand them upright, but it was close enough.